Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday afternoon. It could even be Saturday morning. So to our friends catching us on a Saturday morning on the other side of the dateline, good morning to you. And as we like to say, wherever you are, we're glad you're here with us. And we've got two great hours with you, I am sure. I feel confident we've got two great hours with you. We've got Jimmy Akin for both hours. And we're going to dip into the mailbag. We've always called this... Ask me anything of the internet variety, but I'm thinking about mailbag. What do you think, Jimmy?
Well, it's possible.
Okay, all right. Well, consider it, because it's a lot to say, ask me anything internet version. And I thought, or we could maybe call it internet mailbag, something like that.
You could shorten it up by just calling it an internet ask me anything.
All right.
Or an internet AMA.
Yeah. And that's what it is. We've got about, I forgot to count the questions, but it's roughly a million questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. But also very well known in the podcasting world because of the Jimmy Akin podcast, which is his younger podcast, and his older podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. How are you, Jimmy Akin?
I'm doing okay. Now, we're pre-recording this. It's scheduled to go out on August 22nd, and August 22nd is a special day for me because it is the Queenship of Mary. It's also the day I was received into the Catholic Church. So this is going to broadcast on the 33rd anniversary of my reception into the Catholic Church. Which is kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. I feel like that's a special number, 33, because we think of Jesus as having died and risen on at the age of 33. So, do you think that's roughly correct? About 33?
He was a little over 33, but yeah, that's the conventional date. And you also mentioned me being known from my podcast, and I was surprised at how known I had become in Catholic circles. Recently, I was in Italy. And I was in Italy a number of years ago, and I was walking down the street in Rome, and these two seminarians were American seminarians were passing, and they recognized me, and they said, "Hi, Mr. Akin." And I thought that was interesting. I didn't think it was too surprising, though, because they were American, and I was scheduled to give a talk at the Pontifical North American College, which is the seminary for Americans in Rome. And so it wouldn't be too surprising that seminarians there had like seen publicity for my talk and would know who I was. So I thought that was interesting, but I didn't think it was too surprising. Well, this time when I was over in Italy, I was recognized by 25 strangers.
Really?
Yeah, I kept count. It started happening at the airport when I arrived, and these were people who were not part of my group. They weren't all Americans. There were like Austrians who recognized me. There was a Brazilian who recognized me, and it started happening so quickly. Just upon arrival, I was recognized by two that I started keeping a list, and it turns out 25 different strangers recognized me, and sometimes multiple strangers in one day. And so I guess due to YouTube and, you know, my podcasts and stuff, my media profile has expanded in the last number of years.
That is wild, though. Like, you were there for what, maybe a week and a half?
12 or
a
days.
12 days. Yeah. And 25, you know, Jimmy.
That's more than two a day.
You actually lived one of my dreams. One of my dreams in this life, and Darren's laughing because I always talk about it, is to be recognized at an airport. So I'm working to it. That's actually a goal of mine. So you have achieved that.
I was recognized both at the airport, both coming and going on the way in.
Oh, now you're just rubbing it in.
I was recognized by an American and an American priest on the way out. Yeah. I was recognized by an American couple and one of their sons.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. It's the reach is extraordinary. It's hard to know now. Because you knew when you were on American media, okay, we're reaching a certain number of people in the United States, but you really don't know where it's reaching now. You have no idea. Mm-hmm. That's why these folks who support the work we do, we have to say, and quite rightly, the people that are supporting Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World or people that are supporting this show, it's getting into places where you would never dream that you were getting.
Yeah.
Because of the availability.
You could be sitting at a cafe in Assisi and a couple of Austrians walk up and, are you Jimmy Akin? Or you can be standing at a papal mass and a Brazilian comes up and says, are you Jimmy Akin? So, yeah. How they recognize me, I don't know. I'm so nondescript.
I know. You really
they
are.
Do it somehow.
They pick you out in a crowd somehow. That's mm-hmm. good for them. So you enjoyed Italy? I'm a little jealous of that as well.
Well, if you want to be less jealous, it was also exhausting, but yeah.
Yeah.
But got to see a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. And getting recognized in airports. All right. Well, I'm going to control my envy right now. But it is a Friday, so that means that there will be today, this morning, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Let's just say what that is before we go to questions.
It's about the mystery of radiation and how we discovered radiation. And it's a very interesting story. It's got a lot of twists and turns in it. But, you know, radiation is one of the defining technologies and discoveries of the 20th century. And so I decided to devote an episode to telling the story of how we discovered it and some of the early things that happened with radiation that nobody was expecting because it had only just been discovered.
Wow. Are the radium girls in this? You told me about them one time.
The radium girls are in this, as well as Radiothor and Marie Curie and Wilhelm Röntgen and all kinds of interesting stuff.
Ah, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World today. That's a fun one. And educational. Fun and educational. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you can get it at mysterious.fm. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts, and more people are getting it at Jimmy's YouTube channel. Just check out Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel to find it. All right, let's go to the mailbag. Can you get me some mailbag music? I want to do mailbag now. All right, internet mailbag. David wants to know this. When was the church really born? From Jesus's pierced side at the cross or at the day of Pentecost?
Well, those are two commonly cited events. I think you can add additional events as well, like the initial preaching of Jesus, the baptism of Jesus, after which he began preaching the gospel and the kingdom of God and so forth. The way I would look at it is the church is a complex reality. And as a result, the church does not have a single moment where it comes into existence, at least from what we can determine. It doesn't have a single moment where it suddenly comes into existence and had not existed in any form previously. In fact, the church is, it even has precedence in the Old Testament. But I think that there is something distinct about the church founded by the Messiah, and you can trace its beginning to different points in the Messiah's career. But there's no place in the New Testament where it says, and this is the moment the church was born.
Yeah.
And so I think what you have to do if you want to ask that question, which the text does not explicitly answer, is look at, well, what are some plausible points for when God did stuff that you could consider the birth of the church? I think the baptism of Jesus is one of them. I think the being born from his side on the cross, the crucifixion is another one. The resurrection is another one. The Pentecost is another one. And since we don't have a definitive answer saying this is uniquely the one, I would say it's all of them, that the church came into existence in different phases. And consequently, you can pick which one you want to use as the marker if you want to insist on the marker for when the church's birthday is. You can kind of pick that. But I would say ultimately we don't have a way of definitively deciding between them. You know, the church's magisterium hadn't definitively decided this. And so I would say it's open to speculation and you can look at it in different ways. But for me, the church is a complex reality that comes into existence in different stages. And we can mark some of those stages very easily based on what Scripture does tell us.
David, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You don't have to travel to an Italian airport to see him. You can see him right here. We'll be right back with more questions for Jimmy right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1981. The FCC license to operate a satellite earth station, the first ever given to an order of nuns, was granted to Our Lady of the Angels Monastery. Mother Angelica flips the switch and EWTN begins transmitting from Irondale, Alabama.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and all sorts of questions coming up. And sometimes these are hard questions, sometimes fun questions. Sometimes I feel like people think Jimmy is a member of the family, so they ask a question you'd ask a family member. And Juan wants to know this, Jimmy. Do you like fish tacos? Now, Juan goes on to say, might be better for a full-length Mysterious World episode, so...
Well, I don't know. Who does he think I am? Tim Staples?
That
I
would... Oh, come on.
No. Just speaking in terms of length, I have no idea about Tim's preference tastes-wise. But I like fish tacos okay. I had not had... Now, I moved out to California in 1993, and at the time, it's likely to have changed, but at the time, fish tacos were kind of a new thing, and we didn't have them in Arkansas, but they did have them in San Diego, and I tried them, and I liked them okay. What I liked even better than fish tacos, though, was fish burritos.
Oh, really?
I liked fish burritos even better than fish tacos. And there was a taco stand near the old Catholic Answers office. And I would regularly go there for lunch and pick up, they had a drive-through, and I'd regularly go there for lunch and pick up fish burritos, and they were really good. I really enjoyed them. There's just something, fish tacos, at least at Rubio's, which I gather was the chain that introduced them.
Yeah, they kind of popularized the fish taco, yeah.
Yeah, they had they put them in a soft corn tortilla, and that was okay, but soft corn tortillas is not my favorite. And one of the things I liked about the fish burritos is that they were in a wheat burrito wrapper.
Oh, yeah.
And I liked the texture and taste of the wheat burrito wrapper better than I liked the taste of and texture of the soft corn tortillas. But they were still good. I'd have them occasionally, but I really liked having fish burritos with Mexican hot sauce on it.
Well, now, this makes me curious. Now you're back in Arkansas. Has Mexican food spread there more than when you left?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot more Mexicans in the state now than there were than there were 30 years ago, and which was something I noticed periodically. I'd come back. And I would like go to the Northwest Arkansas Mall for Christmas. You know, I'd like come back for Christmas, and I'd do Christmas shopping, and so I'd go to the mall and stuff like that. And I remember being in the Northwest Arkansas Mall one year. This would be 25 years ago at this point, but for the first time hearing Spanish spoken in the Northwest Arkansas Mall, and that was just a sign of how many immigrants to the area we were having from Spanish-speaking lands. And they're definitely part of the landscape here now.
And it does seem like Mexican food has spread everywhere now.
It kind of follows Mexicans. Yeah.
There was a time where there was places where it would be awful if you got Mexican. It would be somebody's attempt at it. But it's everywhere now. It's like pizza.
You know, it's like everyone wants the kind of food they grew up with. And so it's, if you move somewhere, you tend to bring your own food along and you make it for others and you start restaurants and things like that. And other people get to enjoy it. There's an old Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, which is I think it's I Accuse My Parents is the movie they were doing, which is a 1950s parental anxiety movie about if you don't raise your kids right, they're going to accuse you later. And so there's this old black and white 50s parental anxiety movie, and the guys who are riffing it are, they're watching this one scene of this down and out kid who later accuses his parents, going down the street. He's all alone in this town and there's no one around and he's just so lonely and forlorn. And one of the guys riffing the movie says, "I don't think I'm going to find any Thai food in this old town."
All right. Back to the questions we go. So it's a qualified yes on the fish tacos, but prefer the fish burrito on that one. Slans mm-hmm. wants to know, I would like to know about Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. Does the word, in quotes, know, refer to knowledge or to a declaration? Doesn't Jesus know the day and hour through his divine nature? How does the hypostatic union work with regards to Jesus' knowledge about an event?
Okay, so the first thing to do is quote the verse so that people know what we're talking about. And Matthew 24:36 says, this is in Jesus' eschatological discourse, which is principally concerned with the destruction of the Jewish temple that happened in AD 70. And he's actually talking about, and this is clear in the parallel in Mark, he's actually talking about the destruction of the temple, not the end of the world. But the verse in Matthew says, "But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, except the Father alone." Now, there's a parallel to that in Mark's version. Mark's version is exclusively about the destruction of the temple. That's the only subject on the table, is when is the temple going to be destroyed? That verse is Mark 13:32, and it says basically the same thing. Now, Slans has asked, does the word know in this passage where it says concerning that day and hour, no one knows, does that refer to knowledge or to a declaration? And the verb in Greek is oida, and it means to know cognitively, the same thing that it means in English. It does not refer to making a declaration. It's not like he's saying, "I didn't come to say this." He's saying, the angels don't know this. I don't know this. Only the Father knows this. That's what the language says.
Okay.
Now, you can propose that he means something different, but that's what the language says. And we always want to start with what does the language say? Also, I would note that this verb is in the perfect tense in Greek, which if I were to translate that, perfect tense refers to something in the past that has continuing effects in the present. And so if I were to translate it freshly from Greek, I would say no one has known that day, not the angels, not the Son, only the Father. So in the past, this has been the case, and it has effects in the present. No one still knows it. So he's emphasizing that this is an ongoing state of affairs. So how do we then understand this? Because Slan says, doesn't Jesus know the day and the hour through his divine nature? Well, he has a divine intellect, and his divine intellect is omniscient and knows everything. So the answer is yes, he does in his divine intellect have this information. But it would seem, at least based on what he's saying, that he doesn't have the information in his human intellect. And that's the position, even though there have been different interpretations of this down through Christian history, the idea that he doesn't have the information in his human intellect, even though he does have it in his divine intellect, is the position that the Catechism of the Catholic Church endorses. If you look at paragraph 474 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says this: by its union to the divine wisdom in the person of the Word incarnate, Christ enjoyed in his human knowledge the fullness of understanding of the eternal plans he had come to reveal. So it elsewhere acknowledges he knows everything in his divine intellect, but here it's saying in his human intellect, he knows everything that he came to reveal, which is a subset of everything, obviously. He didn't come to reveal everything. It then goes on to say what he admitted to not knowing in this area. And admitted is a factive verb that communicates this is true. So he admitted not knowing certain things in this area. It says what he admitted to not knowing in this area, he elsewhere declared himself not sent to reveal. So this is one of the things he hadn't come to reveal. And therefore, he didn't have that in the download from his divine intellect into his human intellect. At least that's the interpretation that the Catechism is proposing. And it's interesting, when you look at the footnote in the Catechism at this point, it references the Mark in parallel to this, Mark 13:32, and it references Acts 1:7, which is where the disciples asked Jesus, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel at this point? And he says, it's not for you to know that stuff. So it's noting that there are things in the future that Jesus had not come to reveal, as indicated in Acts 1:7. And that explains why he says he didn't know them in earlier passages like Mark 13:32 or Matthew 24:36. He didn't come to reveal these matters, and so according to the Catechism, he didn't have them in his human intellect.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Slance, for that question. We've got time for another before we have to go, and this comes from Repentant Sinner 7472. Congratulations on the repentance. Repentant Sinner wants to know this. In Steve Weidenkopf's book, Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church, he stated, quoting Hilaire Belloc, that the way we use the term Christianity today is an ahistorical post-Reformation term and not an accurate portrayal of our faith. Has the term Christianity evolved over time to mean something different than originally intended? For example, creating an equal standing among all Christian denominations as opposed to one single faith.
Okay, so I haven't read Steve Weidenkopf's book, Timeless, nor have I read what Hilaire Belloc is being quoted to have said, although it wouldn't surprise me that Hilaire Belloc would say such things. The fact is, language changes over time, and it changes in different communities. It changes to meet different needs as perceived by the language users within specific linguistic communities. And there are advantages and disadvantages when that happens, but there's no single usage that is definitively right and that everybody must adhere to, unless some authority determines that and says everybody must use the term this way. Well, the magisterium has no problem with using the term Christian to apply to groups that are not in full communion with Rome. That's why, for example, they have the dicastery for the promotion of Christian unity, in which through which they conduct dialogues with different groups of Christians. Now, it therefore would be an interesting question, and I'm open to seeing data about, well, did people prior to the Reformation not use the word Christian, for example, for the Eastern Orthodox who were not in communion with Rome? I'd have to see data on that, and I don't have data on that. It would kind of surprise me if they did, if they said, oh yeah, they're not Christians, when plainly they're baptized and they worship Christ and they have almost all the elements of the Christian faith as understood in the Catholic Church. my understanding is, my suspicion is, they would have been called Christians, but they would have been identified as schismatic Christians, namely Christians who aren't in full union, using the language of the time. But it's definitely true that the term Christian has changed meaning over time, and I can show that from the New Testament. Because when you read the New Testament, there are only three passages where the word Christian appears. And it is made clear that this was not originally a term that Christians used. In Acts 11:26, Luke writes that when Barnabas had found Paul, he brought him to Antioch. For a whole year, they met with the church and taught a great many people. And in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians. Notice it's passive voice. They were called Christians. They didn't call themselves Christians. They themselves said, we follow the way. But other people called them Christians, which would kind of be like today saying someone is a Christer. It's this new term that links you to your origin. It's not very polite either. And we see that later in Acts. In Acts 26:28, Agrippa says to Paul, in such a short time, would you persuade me to be a Christian? Would you get me to be a Christer in such a short time? And similarly, in 1 Peter 4:6, Peter says, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. So you can see how by Peter's time, Christians are starting to embrace the name. But it wasn't originally our own term for ourselves, and it's changed meaning over time.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. More questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns to the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Join special guests Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and an all-star lineup of speakers September 26th through 29th. Spend time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and our special guests right here in beautiful San Diego. Seats are still available, but going fast. We'd love to see you there. Register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
The Stigmata, the appearance of Christ's wounds on ordinary believers. Is it real or fake? What's the evidence? And if real, what could God's reason be for causing this? In God's Wounds, author John Clark offers what may be the most thorough, honest, and faithful reckoning with the stigmata ever written, examining the evidence and making sense of it both medically and spiritually. Order God's Wounds today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Lots of questions in for our guest, the world famous Jimmy Akin. That's gonna be, maybe that's a bit much. Maybe that would make you feel like a lot of pressure to really deliver. If I start calling you the world famous Jimmy Akin, that might be a bit much.
It might be a bit much. Although I am secretly famous.
Now I don't know what secretly famous means. What does that mean?
Well. So one of my mentors as a square dance caller is a guy named Nasser Shuker.
Okay.
And he's a real character. And he apparently was in, I think it was somewhere in Scandinavia, or so it may have been like an airport in Denmark, let's say. And Nasser being the loud, rambunctious character that Nasser is, he was apparently in this airport yelling about how he wanted to meet someone famous. And so the locals found a guy who was at the airport and who was famous for like a scientific discovery and brought him up to Nasser to meet him. and Nasser was so pleased by this that he wrote about it in his email newsletter.
Okay.
And I happened to read it. And so, you know, I don't make a big deal of myself when I'm, you know, in different roles. I don't talk about like, oh yeah, I'm this well-known Catholic apologist if I'm in a square dance circle.
Right.
So, why show off, you know, just I'm there to do my thing and enjoy the activity and so forth. But since Nasser had raised this question, I mentioned to him, I emailed back and said, if you're, you know, it's surprising who you meet that's secretly famous. I believe he had used the term secretly famous for this guy they introduced him to. But I said, Google my name and look at the number of hits you get. Because at the time, Google would display that. It still has that information. You just have to go looking for it.
But
at the time, on the page, it would just say, you know, there's like a million hits here. So I told him to Google my name and see how many hits there were. And he did. And he was impressed to learn that he knew a second secretly famous
Famous Jimmy. Though that, yeah. I will do. I will. Secretly famous Jimmy Akin, our guest. But which is funny because I bet there are a lot of people who know you who are just discovering that you're a square dance caller. Mm-hmm. So you're secretly famous the other way as well.
To a certain extent.
Yeah. This one comes from Longbeard. And Longbeard wants to know this, Jimmy. A hard question, Longbeard. What does divine simplicity mean in terms of the mind of God? Does he think about things? How does that work?
Well, so this is something that there has been a lot of discussion of philosophically and theologically, and there are different attitudes towards exactly how divine simplicity should be understood and exactly what it means in terms of divine cognition. And I don't have, you know, this isn't a college course, so I don't have time to go through them all, but I can give you a few things that I think may be helpful. The first one is God does have awareness of things. So he does have a divine intellect, but his intellect does not work the same way ours does, because our intellects are characterized by limitation. You know, we have only a limited amount of knowledge, and we have to acquire new knowledge over the course of time because we're time-bound creatures. And so as the world around us changes, we have to learn about those changes and what the world is like now. We also have a limited amount of information processing capacity, so we have to reason our way through chains of reasoning. So you may observe, it's cloudy and there's water on the ground, therefore it must have rained. And we would work our way through that kind of one step at a time if we're putting it in formal terms. Well, all of those things are due to the limitations that human intellects work with. But God, being unlimited, does not have, or infinite, that's just what infinite means, is unlimited. God does not have those limitations in his intellect. So God is aware of everything all at once. He is not bound by time. He exists in an eternal now outside of time. And so he sees all of history all at once, every fact about it. He knows everything. And he therefore doesn't have to reason his way through chains of inference the way we do. He, in fact, being outside of time, time doesn't pass for him. So he can't reason his way through chains of inference because time doesn't pass for him. He sees the entire chain all at once. And so those are some of the things that apply to how God's intellect is different than ours. But what Longbeard is asking is more specifically about divine simplicity. and how that might affect his intellect. Well, so simplicity is the quality of not having parts. That's what the term means in a philosophical, theological context. And it is a teaching of the church that God is simple, that he is not made of parts the way we are. So the fact that God is simple has often been understood to mean that he doesn't think in propositional ways the way we do. Our minds, we tend to put things in propositions like it is cloudy, there is water on the ground, therefore it has rained. Those are three different propositions. But it's commonly proposed, at least by authors, for example, in the Thomistic school, that God does not think propositionally, that if he did, then his intellect would have parts and it would violate simplicity. And so the proposal is, and this is not church teaching, this is a theological proposal that's been made to explain the church teaching of simplicity, is that God thinks non-propositionally. He's just aware of everything all at once, and he doesn't have to break it down into individual propositions the way we do. So he has a more holistic knowledge of things compared to our knowledge of things in parts.
Longbeard, thank you very, very much for the question. I do think there's some association in English of the term simplicity with something low or something not...
sophisticated?
Yeah, not sophisticated. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like it's like in the Pirates of Penzance, when the pirates discover that Major General Stanley is not actually an orphan, and they are astonished to learn that he has practiced on our credulous simplicity.
Yeah, right. But like, if we call a person simple, like nobody uses that term anymore, but there is that tradition of, oh, he's simple, meaning not
slow.
Yeah, not intelligent, yeah. I guess. Yeah. And that's one you got to work your way past.
Funny how words have different meanings in different contexts, isn't it?
Yeah, but they bleed over. That's the thing. And so I think a lot of people have to work their way past certain meanings to settle on what the philosopher means by simplicity.
That's why I clarified what it means in a philosophical context. Yeah.
Next, a happy pilgrim wants to know, I had a friend recently tell me that the traditional Latin mass community just wants to have the same liturgy as it was since the beginning. I thought we had several liturgies over the centuries. When I told him that, he said, no, it's the Roman canon that has always been the same, and Vatican II changed that. He said if we could just keep the Roman canon in place as it's always been, the issues would be resolved. Is that true?
Okay, so I'm dependent on what a happy pilgrim says about this encounter. I wasn't there, so there could be something lost in transmission. But assuming that happy pilgrim is reporting accurately and completely what the person said, I would say there are some inaccuracies there. The fact is that the church has had multiple different forms of liturgy throughout the last two millennia. Now, the traditional Latin Mass goes back a good ways, but it does not go back to the first century. Scholars have linked the formation of an early form of the TLM to Pope Gregory the Great, or Pope Gregory the First, around AD 590. But it's clear, and it developed since then. It wasn't it hadn't been in the same form. I mean, popes all the way down through the ages have been adding and subtracting bits from it. Like, for example, Pope Leo XIII added the St. Michael prayer at the end. That was a new prayer that hadn't been part of the liturgy before. When it comes to the what's known as the Roman canon, it's clear that doesn't go all the way back to the beginning. And one of the ways you can show that is it's got this massive list of saints in it. And those saints didn't all live in the first century. So, you know, for example, the saint list includes Cosmas and Damian, and they died around the year 300. So their inclusion in the Roman canon couldn't have been before, you know, the year 300 at the earliest. So it's clear that this does not go all the way back to the first century. It is a creation of later ages. And so, you know, I wouldn't misrepresent it by claiming a greater antiquity for it than it actually has. I think we need to be accurate in the antiquity that we claim for it. We don't want to diminish its antiquity, but we also don't want to exaggerate its antiquity. We want to be accurate. Also, if the claim is we just need the Roman canon, well, we've still got the Roman canon. It's now called Eucharistic Prayer Number 1. So it's still there. And if you want a priest to say the Roman canon, just encourage him to say Eucharistic Prayer Number 1. I don't think that, and you can even say it in Latin if you want. So I think that there's some oversimplification going on in this question, whether the oversimplification is on the part of how the question is being presented or if it's in the views of the person that, you know, that Happy Pilgrim was talking to, that I can't say. But I think there is oversimplification here. I'd also say that I think that I support the traditional Latin Mass movement of if they prefer the previous liturgy and they want to have it, great. I think that's wonderful. I want them to have it too. I don't know that them having it is going to fix every problem in the church, though, because the church has problems from multiple sources, and I don't think you can just say everything would be great if we just had the pre-1962 version of the liturgy. There were problems in the church before 1962, and even if that liturgy was being used universally today, which I don't think there's a realistic chance of, but even if it were, there would still be problems in the church today. So I don't think we should look at the liturgy as a magic cure-all for the problems in the church. But I do think that some people grow closer to God, they relate to God better through the more traditional form of the liturgy, and I want them to have it.
Happy Pilgrim, thank you very much for the question that has taken us to the break. We'll be right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin from the Internet Mailbag on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
A special item on EWTNRC.com this month is the Chrism Biblical Oil Devotional Candle, an exclusive EWTN design. This chrism-scented candle is crafted with pure beeswax and soy wax, hand-poured into an 8-ounce tin featuring the Kairos symbol, which represents Christ. Fill your home with this sacred scent or share it with loved ones. To order, go to EWTNRC.com and search for item number CCBW.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Hey, the big Catholic Answers Conference coming up just a month from now, a month and 3 days. We start on September 25th. If you'd like to come, just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com and find out all about it. Jimmy will be one of the featured speakers there. All of our apologists will be speaking. Chris Stefanik will be speaking. Dr. David Anders. We're going to have a great time. We'd love it if you'd come. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Next question comes from Divine Mercy Catechesis, and it's a brief question. As a sci-fi fan, what do you think of Futurama?
Okay, so Futurama is a science fiction-based animated television show created by the producers of The Simpsons. And I've seen some Futurama and I've enjoyed it. It's not like The Simpsons. It's not entirely family friendly, but it's substantially, you know, very interesting and funny, and it's not as bad as some animation in terms of family friendliness. There are some shows I just don't watch because of how family unfriendly they are. But Futurama is one that, you know, if you're an adult and you can have a bit of a thick skin, you know, it's got a lot of enjoyable content in it. I think in particular of certain individual scenes that I've seen that I think are just really funny. The story in Futurama is about a guy named Stephen J. Fry, who's from the 20th century, and he's a pizza delivery boy. But he accidentally gets frozen cryogenically and wakes up in like the 30th century or something. And so this is a massive culture shock to him. And he meets this one-eyed purple-haired woman named Leela, and is talking to her about how bad his life was in the 20th century and how he didn't have anybody and how nobody cared about him and how people treated him like dirt and stuff like that. And she says, well, Fry, one thing I can tell you is here in the future, no one is ever going to treat you in a dehumanized manner. Now strip naked and get on the probulator. So I think about that. There's also an episode where they go to the edge of the universe and they have those kind of telescopes, you know, that you look in them with both eyes and you put a coin in get to see through the telescope, and they're looking out the edge of the universe with those. And Leela and the other regular characters, they're taking Fry there because he's never been to the edge of the universe before. And Leela's saying at that point, like, you know, it's funny, you live in the universe, you never think to go these places until you have a visitor.
Right.
There's also a really great sequence in about the dangers of dating robots. Mm. Because it tells a cautionary story about a boy named Billy who he's kind of patterned like he's from the 1950s, but he has that kind of boy next door 1950s quality. But instead of dating and marrying and reproducing with a human girl, he gets obsessed with his Marilyn Monroe bot. And all he wants to do is make out with his Marilyn Monroe bot. And as a result, he becomes an old man and he never gets married and he never has children. And that leaves Earth open to being invaded by aliens and conquered, because there's no new generation to stand up for Earth. And all of this is like a cautionary film, you know, about the dangers of don't date robots. And it's endorsed by the space pope. And who's like this alligator-like creature. Yeah.
Right.
But I think the space pope and like the real pope would endorse the don't date robots message.
Yes. Right.
There's also another episode where one of the regulars in this is a robot named Bender. And Bender at one point is having a dream. And he's like locked in a robot apartment, which appears to be like the size of a closet, but he's got Stephen Fry over and they're locked in this closet together, and Bender's asleep and having a dream. And in his dream, he's saying stuff like, "Hey, honey, how you doing? You want to kill all humans?" And he keeps having this dream about being in a romantic relationship with another robot and killing all humans. And it's getting on Fry's nerves, and he wakes Bender up, and Bender is like, "Hey, Fry, I just had this great dream, and you were in it." So there's a lot of funny stuff in Futurama.
I just looked up the space pope. He is very crocodile-ish. Thank you very much. That question came from Divine Mercy Catechesis. Thank you for the question, Divine Mercy Catechesis. This one comes from Cheeky Sheeky. "Hi, Jimmy. I'm a lapsed Catholic, baptized as a child, but really wanting to return to the church and rediscover my faith. What steps should I take to do this?"
Well, so if you've been baptized, you are Catholic, and you can, at your age, in principle, begin living a sacramental life. You would need, like, in order to receive the Eucharist, you'd need to go to confession if it's been some time since you've been to confession. If you have not been confirmed, you'll also want to get confirmed at some point, but you don't need to do that before going to confession or return into the Eucharist. You can do those independently or of getting confirmed. I would suggest, well, you're already watching Catholic Answers Live or my channel on YouTube, and those are great resources to learn more about your faith. And then you can also specifically look up information at Catholic.com about how to go to confession, especially if it's been a while. You want to make an examination of conscience, and there are guides to examining your conscience that can be found online that can be of help. And there are also practical guides, like we have, I think, a tract at Catholic.com about how to go to confession. But then you can go to confession and be absolved and begin receiving the Eucharist, assuming you believe what the Church believes about the Eucharist, which we also have lots of great resources about at Catholic.com. So you can, you know, kind of work through those two issues and begin living a normal sacramental life. If you've not been confirmed yet, then you'd need to see about doing that as well. You can also immediately start going to Mass on Sundays and other days, depending on the schedule that it's offered in your area at down in Australia. So I would just say, well, keep watching Catholic Answers Live, keep listening to or watching good Catholic videos on YouTube to learn about your faith, and start going to Mass. And then when you're ready, go to confession and begin receiving the Eucharist again. And if you need to, go get confirmed as well. And that's something you'll need to talk to the people in your parish about, and they can help guide you through that process as well.
God bless you, Cheeky Cheeky. Thank you very much for the question. On we go. Like, we got time. I got time to do another question. Steenie2499 wants to know this. Is it sinful to have your ashes combined with the ashes of a beloved pet, meaning in the same container mixed together? A friend's mother is considering, and I had no idea how to respond.
Okay, so there is not a direct answer. This isn't so much a moral question as it is a legal question. You know, people's bodies fall apart after they die. And I mean, that's the whole thing, you know, dust thou art and to dust thou shalt return. They knew very well in the ancient world, people's bodies decay. And that matter from which they've decayed into gets mixed up with other matter as well. So it's not like we have to keep our bodies pristinely preserved and isolated from all other matter. We tend to do something similar to that in our culture, but they didn't in Jesus's. In Jesus's culture, they would put your body in a tomb, and they would expect it to decay. They didn't embalm it the way we embalm people today. And after a year, all you'd have left were bones. So they'd come back after a year and clean the bones and put them in a bone box known as an ossuary for long-term storage. But all that other matter that your body was made out of, that got dispersed into the environment. And so so the idea of keeping our bodies like in pristinely isolated in a coffin or some other container is not morally required. Now, can our bodies be mixed, like the cremated remains of our bodies be mixed with other cremated remains? Well, there was a document that came out from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith in the last couple of years where they answered that question as yes. Now, they weren't answering it in terms of with a pet, but of can you create a memorial which has the cremated remains of multiple people together in that memorial? And the answer was yes, as long as you preserve the names of those people so that people can come by and pray for them. This is similar to recently I was in Rome, and they have a Capuchin monastery there where they didn't cremate anybody, but they have these ossuary chambers where they have all this artwork made by combining the bones of the monks who used to live in the monastery. So you'll see, like, here's a chandelier made from the bones of former monks and stuff. And that also involves combining the in this time in a non-cremated form, but it involves combining the bones of individuals. So there's not a moral problem here. There's also not a legal problem, as far as I can see. Basically, if you think about it, I mean, take cremation out of it for a second. What you're proposing is you got a favored pet and you're being buried with the pet. Well, there's no law against that, as far as I know. And Psychelet, as I'm sure you know, people have been buried with favorite pets forever in human history, back to the Neolithic. And so I don't see a legal problem here if it's something that your friend's mother is considering.
I don't know how the pet's going to feel about it, but we're going to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we've got a lot more to come. Lots more questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.